This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
Today's episode of the Elevate Podcast is being brought to you by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is award-winning case management software used to manage personal injury, medical malpractice, MDL, class action law firms all over the United States. Great program, highly recommend it. Check them out at smartadvocate.com. Today's episode is being brought to you by Expert Institute. Expert Institute is the place to go for everything involving experts to help you win your case. Check them out at expertinstitute.com. And today's episode is being brought to you by Hype Legal. Hype Legal is a one-stop shop for all of your digital marketing needs. Check them out at hypelegal.com.
Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. I'm Rahul Ravipudi.
And I'm Ben Gideon. How are you doing, Rahul?
I'm doing great, Ben. Ben, so last session, you asked me about my wife because she's amazing, and it would be unfair of me to do anything else but to ask about your wife and how amazing she is. So tell the listeners about your all-star wife.
Oh, gosh. I mean, we don't have to do my wife just because I asked about your wife, but if you feel
no.
the need to. I mean, my wife is definitely probably similar to you. I feel like I married up. You said people refer to you as Smitha's husband. In my world, literally, I'm known as Sarah Gideon's husband because my wife was sort of a public figure. So that's a very true facet of my existence. If I'm in a grocery store, people will come up to my wife and then, you know, she'll say, and this is my husband. So that's the world I've lived in. So my wife was, she shares something in common with your wife in that she has Indian heritage. Her father immigrated to the United States from India, was a pediatrician, and married her mom, who was second generation Armenian immigrant. Her mother immigrated from Armenia after the Turkish invasion and that era. And then, so my wife got into politics and ended up becoming Speaker of the House for our state. And then she was the Democratic nominee for the United States Senate in the last cycle, where she ran against Susan Collins, our incumbent senator. The polls from the beginning of the race all the way through the day before Election Day showed that my wife, Sarah, had a really good chance to win. I think everybody expected her to win, but on Election Day, she lost. So there you go. I think that's a good parallel to the work we do as trial lawyers, where you can go through a whole trial and get all the positive affirmations and the jury's smiles and tears and feel like you're connecting with people. And then the verdict comes out the opposite way and you wonder what just happened. And that's kind of how we felt with the election. So that's my wife. Thanks for asking.
No, of course. Amazing. I can't actually wait to meet her soon.
Early on, I asked her if she wanted to come on. A lot of people have tried to get her to come on various programs, shows, interviews, the main media after the election. And she has declined all media requests since the election. She just didn't want to participate in that anymore. I teased her that she should come on my podcast, and she also declined. But maybe both of our wives could come on together, and then, you know, we could do that. But
I love it. I love it.
Well, thank you for asking. So we're thrilled today to have Andrew Garza on the show. Andrew is, I feel like we don't have as many lawyers from New England as we should and the Northeast United States. Seem like we're heavily weighted towards California and maybe the Western United States. So it's nice to have somebody who's kind of right down the road from me in Connecticut. And Andrew's had a tremendous success lately with some incredible verdicts. But welcome to the show, Andrew.
Good morning. Welcome. Thanks for having me.
So what we like to do before we get into the specific cases and some of your, you know, huge verdicts recently and successes is just get to know you a little bit. So tell us about yourself and your journey to get to this place where you're a highly successful trial lawyer?
Well, it's very kind. You know, I'm just happy to be a trial lawyer. And, you know, I don't know, I think maybe a little bit of my upbringing is perhaps different given my age than some others. My parents were divorced young. Sort of interestingly, my dad got married and he was gay. So I have a mom and I have two dads, which is a little bit different about me. And I think it's a strength. I mean, it's made me who I am. I mean, I've always sort of, I think we've tried to take an approach that is respectful of who people are and what their life experience is. And I think that that's shaped a lot of the way that I've looked at the world growing up. I didn't always want to be a lawyer. Actually, I naively went to college thinking I wanted to be a computer science engineer. Been building computers and always liked technical stuff since I was little, and quickly learned that that was it was more fun as a hobby than as a vocation. So pivoted when I was in college to English and then political science as a means to get to law school. I always liked debate. I liked, you know, sort of the cliche story of why maybe a law school initially. But I liked debate. I liked the idea of being able to help people. I liked the challenge. Went to law school in Boston. I followed my wife, who I think I should be called Dr. Jennifer Garza's husband, to be quite honest, because I too was very fortunate to marry someone way above my weight class, I guess. And, you know, so we went to Boston, followed her up there. She was there for grad school. Initially, all I wanted to do was criminal law. I mean, every class I took was criminal law. I knew I wanted to be a trial lawyer. I really enjoyed mock trial, and I never knew that I'd end up doing injury work. So I graduated in 2012. Economy was not great for lawyers. There was a glut of lawyers. I ended up moving back to Connecticut with my wife, clerking for about a year, and then moved into insurance defense, which it seems like that's maybe the birthing ground of a lot of trial lawyers based on some of the episodes I've listened to. So, I made it way less time than most people. I made it about 3 months before I started looking, 6 months, you know, and then my wife and I had a conversation. And I just said, look, if this is why I went to law school, quite honestly, I've made a huge mistake. I mean, the hours that they want, the work that I'm doing, I don't enjoy it. This is not what I thought it was. And it was really a moment of, it was a decision point. And I had always wanted to open my own practice. And I remember my wife and I were sitting on the sort of deck of our apartment in unglamorous parts of Connecticut. And she said, okay, well, if you want to do that, I support you. And then very astutely, she said, well, but how are we going to pay our bills? So I said, okay, well, I'd waited tables and bartended for about 10 years, which I think is another fun piece of, you know, I like that work. I like people. And so I said, look, okay, I'll open my practice. I'll work during the day. I'll call the restaurant up that I worked at before I went to law school, and I'll work nights. So I was bartending maybe 3 or 4 nights a week while I opened a practice in the fall of 2013. And then fortunately was able to work myself out of that, out of bartending nights, not because I didn't like the work I did, but it just was a lot. And it's hard to answer phone calls and do intakes when you're trying to mix drinks, at least covertly, or with credibility. So, you know, ultimately we ended up developing that practice. I partnered with my now co-founder of Connecticut Trial Firm, Ryan McKean. We started trying cases together. A lot of the work that we did started at what was then the Reptile, and now is Keenan Trial Institute down in Atlanta. We'd go down there. So a lot of our practice was and remains very focus group heavy. And since really 2016, we've built a practice in earnest that is geared towards just trying cases in the best way we can with the state of the art, continually working on self-improvement. And I've just fallen in love with the work. I really love the creativity it affords, the challenge, and really being able to help people too.
So your law firm, Connecticut Trial Firm, first of all, that's a pretty good name. Did you have any trouble getting that name that was available when you went to start your practice?
We made some people mad because the Connecticut Trial Lawyers Association is our state plaintiffs bar, which we're very supportive of and we love. But we were thinking about branding ourselves and, you know, for the future. I mean, for the long term. And we're not, you know, we understand why people may brand themselves names, but we said, look, you know, you gotta, first of all, I mean, if we're going to get cool shirts printed, you have to get them reprinted if you're going to add names of partners. but also it has the advantage of being pretty SEO optimized. So it was available surprisingly. And we had some phone calls initially where people would say, are you the Connecticut Trial Lawyers Association? And then we kind of figured out that those were people from that organization that were maybe a little upset about our branding, but we've made peace and are mutually supportive and really wouldn't be here too without their support.
Oh, it's a good name and memorable. My friend from law school started a firm he called the Boston Law Group, which I thought was a good name, except for a long time he was the only lawyer in it. And I tried to point out that a group can't just be one person. Then he got a second lawyer, and I don't think two people can be a group either. I think the minimum for a group has to be three, but anyway. But yeah, good name. And so I'm looking at your website now. I mean, you have, looks like, I don't know, 17, 20 lawyers, a lot of lawyers, right? So you've grown your practice.
Not all lawyers, but I think we're up to about 27, 28 people now, six lawyers practicing.
Oh.
And yeah, we've been very grateful for the folks that have come and joined us over the years.
So just flashing back to your start as a legal professional, the 3 to 6 months you did in insurance defense, what about that practice made you so quickly not enjoy it?
It was a combination. So my father-in-law has done in-house insurance defense work for a long time. So he's always been a mentor and a support for me and is also a part of why we are who we are as a firm. And so on the one hand, I had sort of a view of what this career track looks like. And his is very different from where I was working privately. You know, and then we had some results where these results would, I guess, be objectively good or disappointing to me as a plaintiff's lawyer if I were on the other side of myself. And, you know, but it's always, what have you done for me lately on the insurance side? Either you were expected to do the thing you did, or you know, they still paid money and they wanted to pay no money when that wasn't, I mean, that was fiction. That was never going to happen. So it was really looking at what that would be for me. It wasn't personally fulfilling. Yeah. I mean, I had a few cases where there were plaintiffs who were liars, and I think we all can get sort of personally invested, even cross-examining a defense witness who, you know, is a liar, or, you know, you're not wanting to take cases as a plaintiff's lawyer where your clients are not honest. But for the most part, it was a matter of if and when people get paid, and they should have been. And so it was like, well, what are we doing? I mean, are you going to win cases on the merits? I don't know if it was Brent Walker or someone that you guys interviewed who said, you know, his mom asked him, you know, or no, I think it was Dan Kramer. He got a defense verdict for, you know, in a rear ender with a teacher. And his mom said, is that justice? And, you know, I sort of remember thinking, well, I'd rather be on the other side of it, where maybe every once in a while a plaintiff gets money who shouldn't, than someone who's hurt not get money. And it's a lot more fun to represent them too.
Now, in your trial practice now, one of the things you said was that you employ state-of-the-art techniques. Give us some of those state-of-the-art concepts that you use.
I don't know. This is a pretty sophisticated listener base. So I think what I mean too is we try to do everything we can technologically to give our clients an advantage. So, I mean, COVID's made in-person focus groups difficult. We run them on Zoom. I think we've developed a particular facility with that. And the last case that we had that we'll talk a little bit about, we worked with some companies out of Boston to develop animations that we used on the focus groups to test the focus groups themselves. We do a lot of data analysis. Probably my wife would cringe because she does it for real. But, you know, sort of as best as lawyers can do, I think we looked at the data we got from our focus groups, developed ideal juror profiles, and then tried to use a lot of that data to select an ideal jury in this case, in the last case we tried. So I think we try to be very analytical and constantly question our assumptions and do what we can technologically or otherwise to help our clients.
You mentioned that you had spent some time maybe the formative learning was based on the reptile and the approach that was kind of pioneered by Don Keenan. Can you talk a little bit about that? And how do you apply that to the cases today? Are you still applying it the way you have, or has that also been an evolution?
I think it's also been an evolution. I mean, anything that's based on focus groups and I think juror attitudes is constantly changing. I mean, we've seen society change so much in the last 5-6 years. Some for the better, maybe some for the worse, depending on where you live and your perspective. But I think that the processes themselves have changed, the systems have changed over the years, but really the heart of it, I think, is still the same. I mean, it's, I remember my father-in-law asking me, because there's all these articles out there, DRI and otherwise, that think they understand it. And I can't get too obviously into sort of the deeper parts of it. But I mean, really, for me, it's just good trial work. I mean, it's trying a clean, coherent case. I mean, understanding that complexity kills your case. Yeah, you can have a complex case, but if it takes you an hour and a half to close, you're probably doing something wrong. So I think, you know, really the core tenets of that, you know, to really simplify. Don't call a witness you don't need to. Don't ask a question you don't need to. Focus group your themes, your visuals. Don't really just streamline your case presentation and present things up front rules-based. I mean, Rick Friedman is sort of pioneered that. The reptiles adopted it. And I think a lot of us have that. You understand that jurors have limited attention span. And I think that's increasingly limited when you have the, you know, the TikToks and, you know, I mean, we're constantly competing for less and less amount of people's mental energy, I think. So the focus groups have sort of, the way we do them has changed a little bit technologically, but you're just trying to understand current attitudes in your case. And some of it is translatable. If you've run them in the past on similar issues, you see commonalities. But sometimes attitudes change. And so I don't know if that answers that, but yeah, it's sort of an evolving process.
Do you feel like this is something that you were naturally suited for from the outset, or have you personally learned and evolved yourself to the point where you feel better in the courtroom? What part of this is nature and what part is nurture in your experience?
As a father of identical twin girls, this is a debate we have in my house pretty frequently. But I think it's a little of both. I mean, I don't mean to say that I think I have some innate talent. I think some people have an innate interest in doing trial work and some people don't. I mean, I have friends who the thought of a courtroom terrifies them, and that's just how they feel about it. It's always been exciting to me. I think I had the pleasure of hearing Angela Duckworth talk out at Lex Summit last week about her book Grit. And I think for better or worse, one thing our lawyers have is, I think, grit. I mean, we can't be outworked. I mean, on this case that we got the verdict on in October, I had one of the defense lawyers tell my partner, I don't think I've ever gotten emails at 3 a.m, let alone emails at 3 a.m. for 3 weeks straight. And I was like, hi, that's me. I don't sleep. So, you know, for better or worse, we've also improved our system. So I get more sleep because sleep is important. But, you know, whatever has to get done, it has to get done. And so I think it's a lot of our folks really putting the hours in, trying to get better, being willing to learn from other people, having an interest in the work. And I think we've kind of grown into it. I think they always say it's easy to look at how other people do trial work and try to just copy and paste and, you know, put their words in your mouth. And it always feels a little bit like an ill-fitting suit. And I think this case in October was one of the first cases that I've had where I really felt comfortable. One of the most stressful experiences of my life, one of the most difficult and rewarding experiences of my life. But I think as a team and as a lawyer, it's one of the very first times I felt comfortable. Like I think I'm funny. Maybe my wife would disagree, or my kids sometimes. But we were able to build a little bit of humor into an otherwise very, very sad case, you know, involving paralysis. And there were some moments of levity, and, you know, it just, I think it allowed the jury to see me, my client, to really connect with us. And it was really nice.
What's your favorite part of a trial, if there is a favorite part?
Closing argument. It's not even close. It's as close to an out-of-body experience, I think, that you get. It's an opportunity that is very rare, either because cases can settle or they settle during the trial or... But for me, that is really one of the most challenging, fun, exciting parts of trial. It's where you can sort of, you're not really trying to convince the jury at that point, I think, if you've done your job. But it really, to me, is the most fun, and I really, really enjoy it.
When do you start writing your closing?
Oh man, that's a loaded question, because so I also have ADHD, which has its gifts and its curses. And for people that also do, they understand that it's do now or do later. That's it. And in this case, though, I actually had lost the last case I tried before this case in October, which was, in my opinion, functionally a rear end motor vehicle case. So it was difficult. So I learned some lessons and then immediately threw myself into a bunch more of the Keenan courses to get better at jury selection, at openings, closings. So that's a long way of saying I drafted a first draft probably in about April before we gave it in October, though it underwent some serious overhaul the weekend before. We gave it on about a Tuesday or Wednesday. So now I'd like to get ahead of it a little more, but I do have a tendency to draft some things last minute. My co-counsel in this case, Andrew Ranks, there's a record that's pretty funny where the judge was expecting me to be in for arguments right before closing. And he said, well, he's still working on the closing. It's classic Garza. And the judge said, well, I guess I don't have enough experience with Mr. Garza to know that, but I'll take your word for it. So I do like to sort of tweak all the way up until the end and handwrite in the margins and try to get the words exactly right. But yeah, I'd like to get a little bit more ahead of it because then you can focus group them and test some of that, which we did. But usually it's a couple of days before to finish it. But in this case, I was a little bit further ahead.
Do you have a sort of ceiling of how long a closing can be for you?
I really think, I mean, closing should be no longer than is necessary. I think a lot of lawyers fall into the trap of marshaling the evidence. And, you know, they really, I think if you're doing that, I think sometimes you kind of have to a little bit, but if you're spending your whole closing here, we have 60 minutes by rule, unless you file a motion. I don't think I've gotten close to that. Even in this case, you know, I reserve some time for rebuttal. And I think in total, maybe it was 45 minutes between my initial closing and then my rebuttal, because I think you have to have this. This is not me. I mean, I'm the beneficiary of a lot of people who've given their time. There's a great lawyer out of New York named Andrew Finkelstein who worked with us the weekend before on this case in the closing. And, you know, he said, and I believe it, you have to have the confidence that you've put on a good case and be able to really focus in on the high level parts of your case and characterize their defense and be able to, you know, to present a compelling narrative. And, you know, I think if you're spending that time marshaling, it's probably not, it's less effective, I think, but other people have their approaches that I respect too.
Can you tell us a little bit about the case first, and then maybe we can go into some of the highlights of the closing?
Sure. So this case, it started over 5 years ago, and basically September of 2017, my guy's a 42-year-old worker in a commercial warehouse in Connecticut. He and his wife, both born in Puerto Rico, moved here, born and raised in Connecticut, raised their families here. And he'd worked at this place for years. It was his home away from home. His wife would say it was his home, and his actual home was his home away from work, I guess. And he loved a job. I mean, loved the job and had a sense of pride in that work. And we had a common bond in that he bartended too. So we always felt like we had kind of come from similar upbringings and blue collar backgrounds and working. And he walked in that day and he was paralyzed. And if you kind of imagine a supermarket, for lack of a better image, you know, he's in aisle 6 and this temp worker is in aisle 7. And unbeknownst to my client in aisle 6, the temp worker is trying to retrieve a load on the uppermost rack. And he ends up making contact with one above my client. It slides off a pallet and it snaps his spine in half, knocks him unconscious. So we started to investigate. We were retained pretty immediately within a couple of weeks after this, sent preservation letters and just started to work our way backwards to understand everything we could. And over the course of the case, you know, basically ended up tracing the light bulbs that fell on my client from that warehouse floor in Hartford, Connecticut, all the way back to the Zhejiang province in China, where they were manufactured by a subsidiary of Philips, put onto a shipping container, transported to, you know, Pennsylvania, and then on to Connecticut. So we were able to track the movement of that product and really look at what the root cause of this was, because I think initially for us, we filed suit pretty early. It looked like it was a temp and a temp company. You know, we knew the temp had a post-accident drug test that was positive. He had had a test the Friday before this Tuesday that was negative. So it was a pretty tight window in which he would have used. We disclosed a toxicologist. We thought we knew what the case looked like. And then the Friday before we were going to open, the judge precluded our toxicologist. So he's never been precluded ever. And we knew from focus groups that we had to keep everybody in the case because the risk that Phillips blamed everything on the temp was high and was persuasive. So, but what we also knew from our investigation was that
Phillips is the manufacturer of the light bulbs.
Yeah. So to sort of outline the parties that ultimately get added, we add the temp company, the owner of the racking system in the warehouse. And then we figure out that this basically giant 1,300-pound cardboard cube should have been stretch wrapped to the pallet. that's the safety standard. That's what Philips's own rule is. And our experts said, look, here's the analysis. Here's the engineering analysis. If they had done this, it couldn't have fallen. So regardless of who touched it, what was going on with the temp, if this had been stretch wrap, $5, 5 minutes was a piece of our opening, it doesn't happen. So, you know, our position was always, yeah, for sure, the temp shares responsibility for this. He's the one that initiated this. He's a part of it. And if I'm Philips, I say, look, we sent this product before. This is what's different that day, this guy. So we always knew that the brunt of the liability was going to fall on the temp company, who had some furnishment problems with his background and Philips. But as soon as that was precluded the Friday before, once we sort of calmed down, well, because, you know, we just said, well, that's a surprise. He's never been this Harvard toxicologist. And but if we can't use it, Philips can't use it either. So we ended up resolving the cases against the temp worker and the owner of the warehouse for $8 million prior to opening statements and then proceeding the trial just against Philips. So it was a much different case. It was a much cleaner case, which was part of the goal too. Really simplified the case to one or two rules, and it streamlined the presentation too. And we also knew from the course of our investigation that there were some pieces of conduct where we, in my opinion, I should say, believe Philips destroyed and hid evidence, and, you know, that were going to really seriously affect their credibility in this case and allow us to make the case about what we wanted to make it about, in terms of this was their product, they didn't do it right, and they're primarily responsible.
And not to bury the lead, but what was the result of your case?
So just before 5 o'clock on October 5th, the jury came back with a $100 million verdict, and they assigned 90% of the responsibility to Philips, Signify, what they spun off, and 10% to the temp. So it was a good bet for the temp company and temp to settle out, because it would have been $10 million. They paid their six in coverage. But 90% was not a day, I think Philips thought. I think they always thought it was everyone else but them, and that came out in their failure to accept any responsibility at all during the case, and we were thrilled, really.
Are you able to share what the last offer was by Philips?
Oh, I love this part. So we had a mediation scheduled for June before we tried the case in August and September, and there were some conditions we put on the mediation. Will come if you have decision makers. Philip showed up without that person, which was a bad start. We ultimately decided to stay and give the presentation we had prepared, and I think that was a part of why the case is resolved against the other parties too. But after that broke down, after about half a day, we filed an offer of judgment compromise in our state for everybody's $26 million in coverage. Well, disclosed at that point. Now we know Philips has $150 million in coverage, which is good. But they, in response, they filed a $1.5 million offer of judgment, which we did not accept. And then we tried the case over about, and I can't even remember anymore, maybe 5-6 weeks. And the Sunday before we were going to close, we got an email from lead counsel for Philips. He said, you know, I have a proposal from the excess carrier. And so I called my client. I drove in on a Sunday with my partner and co-counsel, and I said, I know I want to close too. It's written mostly. And, you know, I'm really hoping to see this thing through, and, but we have to hear him out. And I was like, you have one case. This is the rest of your life. You got to hear him out. Fortunately, the conversation was short because the proposal was a high low of 1 million, 4 million. So that was pretty easy. They never really put a real choice to us, which can make this work easier sometimes. It's a lot harder when you get $15, $20 million on the table and you got to tell your client, look, we've run 10 plus focus groups. We feel like that number is low, but this is an inexact science. You know, it's not even that sometimes. So, you know, you have to make a choice for yourself, and we can make recommendations. But fortunately, it was never really a decision we had to make. We got to go forward and try the case and see what the jury wanted to do with it. So
it's amazing.
So with that backdrop, give us some of the high points of the closing. What, first of all, what was your, obviously you had a lot of evidence in over many weeks of trial, and you're not going to try to rehash all the evidence. So what is your strategy going into closing? What are you trying to accomplish? And then kind of give us the highlights of how you did that.
Sure. So really, I mean, this is not going to be news to anybody else here necessarily, but I mean, the goal in part is to empower the jury too, right? To give them the tools they need to reach the right result. We actually planted some seeds in opening. We took some risks, and I think they just felt right for this case, a case of this size. Like I told the jury in opening that when they first came to the courthouse a few weeks ago, we couldn't tell them much about the case and that we couldn't tell them that they'd been seated on one of the most important cases in Connecticut history. So, you know, I told them that at the end of the case, I'd stand before them and I'd ask them to award life-changing money, you know, to my clients whose lives had been forever changed, you know, and I don't like to get into money typically in opening, but I thought that this was a case where we wanted to talk about it, at least superficially. And the other thing I did.
Are you allowed to suggest a number in Connecticut?
Yeah, you can. And I did in closing, and I think you can in opening. I'm not a fan of getting into money until I think the jury thinks I have any credibility. And I think they expect us as plaintiffs lawyers to do that. And I think it sort of, if it jives with what they expect us to be doing in voir dire and opening, I think it can hurt you and they maybe makes them less receptive, but we can. And I did in closing. And the other thing we did in opening that was maybe a little risky is I told them, I said, look, we're taught as young law students that you should never make promises to a jury that you may not be able to keep. And I said, you know, but I've seen the courage my clients have lived their lives with over the last 5 years. So I'm going to break that rule. Phillips told us they're going to bring these employees in, the very same employees that I've just told you we've caught, I think hiding evidence, lying under oath. And I'm going to bet you based on the evidence we have that they're going to sit in that box and they're going to do it again. And we're going to catch them again with something new. And that turned out to be accurate at trial. And we felt pretty confident that that was going to happen based on what we had at that point. You know, we took some risks and ultimately the case was tried based on two rules. I mean, you know, product seller has to secure the product to the shipping pallet to prevent injury and harm. You got to secure it, got to send safe. And parties to a lawsuit shouldn't destroy evidence to prevent injury, harm, and injustice. And the court, there was a sort of an interesting issue where we caught some of this evidence destruction stuff later in the case. We tried to add the claims and the court said, no, there's a lot of defendants here. You can have your own separate lawsuit with that if you want. So they really limited the amount of evidence we could get into in this case. But I was telling Raul, well, there's actually a second, as a federal court case that's pending with some fraud and evidence destruction and other claims we call Cruz 2. That's going on too. And that arises out of us basically Phillips taking the position that this object that fell on our client in the OSHA photograph initially wasn't even their product, which we proved to be false. And then they said, well, if it is our product, it was modified because the way it looks isn't the way it could have left our facility in Pennsylvania. And one of the key reasons they said was because it had this green plastic banding on it, which my team in my office are probably cringing if they've heard the words green banding, because it's something we talked about over years. And that becomes relevant because I said, okay, look, when the director of logistics for all of North America for Phillips Lighting tells you that's not mine, I know it's not mine, you start to worry. You go, okay, well, whose is it? What happened to it? We sued every single person that touched it from the time it left that warehouse at that point, because on the assumption that it had been modified. Ultimately, that didn't bear out to be true. We went to inspect the warehouse in January of 2021. And that's when things got a little interesting because there had been an arrangement about what we could see and how long we could spend on site. And my expert drove down from Lansing, Michigan. I drove from Connecticut and we get there and it just doesn't look right. This is a busy commercial warehouse that they exclusively own and control. Every upper shelf is empty in the whole warehouse. And they had sort of built this theme. It's not based on a rule, but it's based in a common sense that, well, why did the warehouse in Connecticut have that object even up that high? Why was a heavy object up that high? And so it kind of looked like they had this warehouse looking like, hey, look, we don't do the thing that's unsafe. Then it got more interesting because we wanted to go look at the wrapping machines and there was resistance. They said, no, we don't, you don't, I don't know about that. And we said, well, we just drove. That's part of the deal. So we get down into that area and we didn't notice at the time, but we got home. And we just happened to look through our photos and we're looking for anything green, anything that even looks like green. And I printed out in an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper. I run into my partner's office and I said, you got to look at this. And there's a single green band hanging out of a trash can of the same color as the product in the OSHA photo in the area where they didn't want us to go. And believe it or not, it gets more interesting because then we said, well, if I'm them, I'm going to say, we didn't have green banded product then, but we have it now. Not great because it's the same color, But we'll see what they say. We'll hold it. And I'm not known for being patient, but I tried. So we deposed their expert, their number two, their number one. And not only did they say there wasn't green banding on the product back then, which is why it's not theirs, not then, not now, not ever. Nothing has come in or gone out or been added or been changed ever in the history of that. They couldn't pick that color green out of a crayon box. And then their expert turned over his photos from an inspection months after ours, where we weren't allowed to go. And he was pretty careful, but we found in the upper right-hand corners entire shelves, very, very hard to see, of green banded product. And then we were able to piece that with our photos and figure out that those exact upper shelves with green banded product were exactly the shelves that were cleared when we went. So suffice it to say, there's a disagreement between us and Philips as to what that means. But I think it's pretty compelling. And we ultimately confronted the number one of that warehouse on video. We made a decision to really see what he had to say about it. We gave him every opportunity to change his testimony, to correct the record, you know, okay, just, and I asked him, I think 13 different ways, no green bands, not then, not now, not ever. And then we share the screen and I say, well, can you tell the jury why there's a green band in the trash can the day we went? It's about the longest pause I've ever seen a witness take in answering a question ever. And he had no good answers, no explanation initially. Tried to come up with one later. And at that point, this was in maybe the fall of 2021. I mean, we said, how do you try this case? I'm hard on my clients in terms of assessing and preparing them. And we had a 10 out of 10 client and his wife, the best I've ever had. We've caught them, I think, or at least I think a jury's going to believe this is a cover up. And he's paralyzed. But undeterred, they pivoted to, well, if it is our product and it is our packaging, it would have fallen anyway. Which we jokingly called the we did him a favor by not dropping the wooden pallet on him too defense. And then ultimately we were able to sort of defeat that, get that expert precluded, and we tried the case. But it was a lot of work over years where the stories were shifting and it felt like they would do and say anything. And they did a trial. The story we heard at trial was entirely different. It was a long, long year, long 5 years, but we're really, truly grateful for the jury seeing our clients and seeing the truth of this.
Have they appealed or are you guys, have they paid the judgment?
So they haven't paid yet. They haven't appealed yet. They filed post-verdict motions that were argued about 6 weeks ago. The court here has 4 months. I'm not sure how long the court will take, but they can. The motion for remitter, motion to set aside. So we're waiting the results of that. We feel like we tried a clean case. We had appellate counsel involved all the way from jury selection through trial, post-verdict motions. We don't think there's a lot there. And, you know, but we'll wait and see. They're going to have to make a really tough decision because the interest on appeal post-verdict is something like $25,000 a day. And we also have the second case with all of this other conduct. And the jury heard a little bit about the green band in the trash can that one day, but not all the rest of it. So if I were them, I'd also question what a retrial looks like. And is that better for me? Since the $100 million in this case is purely compensatory.
That's got to be one of the largest single plaintiff verdicts in Connecticut history, isn't it?
For a whole week, which we were, it was the largest verdict in Connecticut history. And then we were very, very happy to be replaced by the Sandy Hook families a week later in the excellent one.
Well, that's a little different though, because they had a lot of plaintiffs.
Yeah. So to your point, it remains, this is the marketing angle, I think, that it still remains the largest physical injury verdict in Connecticut history. There were emotional distress claims in the Sandy Hook case that are very, very valid and worthy. And at the time, our client's wife, Emily, who's a rock star, her verdict was $10 million, which is still, I think, and remains the largest loss of consortium verdict in Connecticut history. So we're very, very proud of that. And, you know, proud that they saw her in her own right, too.
We'd like to thank the sponsors of the Elevate podcast, Steno, national court reporting service that allows trial lawyers to defer the costs of court reporting until the end of the case. Take a look, steno.com. And by Law Pods. Law Pods is the podcast production company that we use to produce the show that produces podcasts for lawyers all over the country. They have an expertise in podcasting and the law. Check them out at lawpods.com.
Did you have a chance to talk to the jury after the verdict?
I think we could have. And it may be something that we do at some point, but because we knew all the post-verdict motions were coming, it was sort of better to let things lie. We'd like to at some point to see what they think, to get their thoughts, but we haven't yet.
And how did the issues that played out in trial and how they played out map to your jury research you did before the trial?
You know, I think the result helps justify the process. I mean, we developed a juror profile of who we thought was good for us. We succeeded in seating jurors who were within that range demographically pretty much perfectly, which doesn't always happen. You know, you never know who's going to come in the pool that day, but we were able to seat people who we thought were good for us. You know, we have a pretty robust jury vetting system where we have people in our office that are trained. So when we get material ahead of time, they have it and they're looking. They know they're looking civil criminal court filings, what they can find on social media, property records. So, I mean, I think we have a little bit more of a sense of who's coming in before the defense does. And I think that's one of the ways that we do things a little differently is that we have people who are trained to be doing that research in conjunction with us. So, I mean, I know, okay, this person is an active Democratic voter who lives here, who follows these things on Facebook, who posts about. And so maybe I'm going to ask less questions of this person. If the defense is starting first, I feel like they're good for us. I don't want to assume entirely they are because they can go the other way. But if I think they're good for us and the defense finishes questioning, maybe we're just going to bond for a few minutes and I'm going to say I'm good. So, you know, that's one of the things that we did. And I think we seated a jury that was exactly who we wanted. And they were excellent for our case.
But in terms of the focus group themes and key issues, do you feel like that also mapped into how the case was presented and how the jury responded to it? Well, you had the toxicology issue, which threw you for a last minute loop.
Yeah. And so one of the things we did that I think prepared us for that, too, is we ran at least three or four focus groups that were basically the same with different people. And so we would start with a very neutral presentation of the facts. And we knew some of these hot button issues, the drug use, possibly the evidence destruction issue, that those were going to skew the numbers. And so what we did is we had focus group participants come on, and then we would roll out in sequence little pieces of information, very little information, and then send them a link and have them assign percentages of responsibility between the parties quietly. They didn't talk about it. They didn't influence one another. And then we would add these other pieces of evidence and have them vote again before they would discuss it. So we had a sense internally of what the percentages we could get based on the defense that we had run in the focus groups was maybe stronger than the one presented at trial on Phillips's behalf. But, you know, we knew what the relative percentages were and sort of how some of these pieces of evidence we thought influenced, you know, people's perspectives. And so we said, okay, well, we know what happens when you add in the drug issue, and we know what happens when you add in this evidence destruction issue, and it shifts it sort of between the parties. So if this is out, we're feeling pretty good about it. You know, we knew from our focus groups that when some of these issues out, we were going to get 50% or higher. We thought pretty generally and consistently on Phillips. I think they thought it was going to be much, much less. And the jury ended up hitting them for 90%. So, you know, so it did map. We knew from our focus groups for sure that being able to show mechanism of injury was critical. Even me explaining to you IL-6, IL-7, maybe you're visual folks and that makes sense to you. But we had focus groups before we had animations done who were like, wait, so was your client in the aisle next to the guy on the reach truck? And so we're going to assign some comparative, or we were like, this is death. We need to go to a company in Boston named Total Trial Solutions. And they did a fantastic job with the animations and being able to show. I mean, they mapped the warehouse with LIDAR so we could get the exact proportions of the racks, used photographs and measurements to get this thing texturally identical. And then our experts' opinions were layered on top of how this object moved, how it wouldn't have fallen if it had been secured. And those few second animations of right way, wrong way, you're able to show a jury very clearly what happened, why it would have made a difference. And so we knew just from the focus groups themselves that this was critical. We had to show them, you know, otherwise you have a risk of confusion that could result in a defense verdict.
Can you tell us how the jury selection process works over there and in this case?
Sure. So it's very different in Connecticut state court. Federal court, we have box voir dire, but state court, you actually have a constitutional right to individual voir dire unless it's waived by both parties. And what that means is that instead of the group coming in and being questioned as a panel, I call it questioning by firing squad. So the jurors come in one at a time. I mean, in this case, there were, during jury selection, three defense lawyers and us, and they would sit and we would take turns, and you'd get through, it was about 45 minutes of questioning on average per juror, per prospective juror to be seated. And so here, a car accident case takes 2 or 3 days. Selection in this case took 3 weeks. We have 6 full jurors and usually 2 alternates because it was still and remains sort of COVID time. We added 4 alternates. So to pick 10 jurors, it took 3 weeks with the exercise of peremptories too.
And how many jurors did you go through before you were able to jointly select these 10?
Oh, I don't know. I'd have to do the math at some point, but usually, I mean, each day, 45 minutes from 10 to 5, you know, you're getting through. I mean, some people you dismiss because of conflicts, but I mean, my guess is we probably went through 50, 60 people at least, probably more, before we found folks that were, you know, sort of neutral and could agree to work with everybody and hear us out.
So that process is actually built into your constitution?
Yeah, it's maybe I'll look up the history of it sometime and why someone thought that was the way. I mean, to some extent, I think it's good, right? So you get people who don't feel like they are in a crowded room. And so the people who don't really feel comfortable sharing, to the extent anyone does in front of 4 lawyers in a chair in the middle of a room, and maybe they have a little more openness. The difficulty, though, is every time I go to a seminar on jury selection and I hear about the benefits of crosstalk and bonding, I go, that's fun. But imagine if you had to seat people who didn't know each other and try to guess how well they're going to work together, which is kind of what we do. And so our approach is just trying to find the best people who fit our profile. We're aware of, okay, maybe this person's going to be a follower. Maybe that person's going to work well with the other person. We think that person may be the 4 person. But you really, it's a challenge. It's a challenge because you can't really bond them. There's no opportunity to do that. But I think over the 3 weeks or the 5-6 weeks of this trial, they definitely bonded.
Yeah, it's interesting because in the progression of approaches that we've had in our state to jury selection, that's been one that has been used because it was sort of perceived as a hybrid or watered down version of panel voir dire by questioning people in camera one at a time. And it eliminates the concern that judges have about one juror's answers tainting the pool, which is, I think, a fiction, but judges entertain that and take it seriously here in the Northeast more than other places. But it is incredibly time-consuming.
Yeah.
And also you lose, like you said, the crosstalk and the permission structure. And it's also, I think it would be very unsettling for the individual jurors to come into a room and be staring across at the firing squad, as you call it, with the judge and, you know, multiple lawyers in suits. It's got to be, you say they may be more willing to share because it's private, but on the other hand, it is a firing squad scenario where they're, you know, the spotlight's on them with all these people staring at them. It just seems like it'd be very unpleasant for the juror. I don't know. Maybe you can work on getting the Constitution amended there in Connecticut, because it would be a big time saver for you if you could do it all.
It's tricky for sure. And really, I think, we're of the opinion that, it can limit access to justice because it makes it very difficult economically to try cases really that are under $100,000. You will. I mean, we'll try any case we take. We make a commitment. We keep it. But I feel like it may affect some of the ways and cases and offers people take because they're looking at things from a resource perspective instead of what's in the client's best interest. And we don't do that, but that's a problem, I think.
So big picture, this is obviously an enormous verdict. It reflects years of work, incredible lawyering, investigation work, strategy, lots of financial resources you guys invested in it, all culminating in this incredible result. So as you move on from that case back to the rest of your cases, and I know you had another great verdict recently, but what are kind of the major takeaways from it, and how do lawyers perhaps listening to this podcast who are aspiring to get to the peak of the mountain with a verdict like that, what kind of advice could you give them?
It's not going to be helpful because it's, no, I mean, I'll just tell you what I think. I mean, the last case I tried before this one, I got a defense verdict. I mean, it wasn't quite a rear ender, but it was pretty close. And they always say that sort of,
yeah. I've been there, by the way. So
yeah, which,
I can
you know, we learned some lessons about the importance of showing mechanism of injury, which may have played a role in this verdict. And, you know, they say that the most dangerous person is a plaintiff's lawyer coming off a defense verdict, right? And, you know, we learn from every case, win or lose. And to me, what was really most interesting is we just did our best every single day to do good work, to be prepared, to put in the time doing the focus groups. And I've read, you know, the results. I listened to Randy Sorrells. I mean, he had a man named Mr. Cruz who was paralyzed too, and like this case. And every time you see these verdicts, you think there's some secret ingredient, that the lawyers have something that you don't, that they're different. And I can tell you that this case went in every day in a way that seemed routine. We'd get up, we'd call witnesses, we'd do our best. We had some gifts at trial that were given to us and we accepted them, you know, but really what was most staggering to us was how sort of normal a process, though a long process, this trial fell, and how exceptional the result was. And so I don't know that I have the ingredients for what, you know, I don't think that it's me. I think we did a lot of work. My team, you know, Alexa Mahoney, Andrew Ranks, my partner, Ryan McKean, the four of us all worked on this case and tried it together. And we just did our best to be prepared and to do good work. And we were blessed by the jury. I mean, I don't know if that helps folks, maybe in the sense that you can achieve good results, even though you get defense on a rear end case, if you work at it and try to improve constantly is the theme. But it still, for us, is unbelievable. And it's hard to believe that we came from a place where we were trying very small cases and had the result we had, and what that will mean for our firm going forward.
Well, amazing. Congratulations on that. And then we haven't had a chance to talk about it, but you already tried a case at the beginning of this year and got an amazing result as well. So you're on a tear right now, and congratulations on that.
Yeah, we really appreciate your joining us today and sharing that story. It's an incredible story and an amazing result and some wisdom that flows from that. If folks want to reach out and find you, have questions or cases in the state of Connecticut, how do they reach you, Andrew?
Sure. You can send me an email. My first name, Andrew, A-N-D-R-E-W, at CT, like Connecticut, cttrialfirm.com. Or give us a call. We're always happy to help work with folks, talk shop, talk strategy. And, you know, we love the work.
Well, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.